watch our grammar today. Don't think I can do that. I wanted to thank you guys for coming out on the field trip. I thought it was quite interesting. I hope everybody appreciated it. I know it was a bit of a long time, but it was a beautiful day. So, any comments about the field trip? Anyone have any thoughts afterwards? Or was it helpful to get a picture of the site or anything? I think there were maybe only one person, unfortunately, couldn't make it, so that was good. What I wanted to do today to start off is to just review a little bit about pump test analysis. I feel that I perhaps covered it a bit quickly last time, and I just wanted to go through some steps and how you'd approach pump test analysis, and I thought we'd go through the unconfined analysis example that I sort of stuffed over a little bit the first thing I want to do is start to just talk about how we analyze data. And when we start with pump tests, we are measuring water levels in wells, right? So the first thing we want to do, you don't have this, so everyone doesn't have to find it. I just did this morning. These are just steps that you will take when you're looking at data analysis for a pump test. And it's embedded in your notes, and it's just expressed differently here, so you don't need to copy it down necessarily. But what I want to talk about or focus on is how you would interpret your data and decide which method of analysis you want to use. So we're going to start there. So you're measuring water levels. You have some idea of what kind of aquifer it is. The first step is to plot up from calculate drawdown, and drawdown is the change in water level. So you're measuring water level. You record the initial value. And then you record the change, and you plot that up versus log time. And why do we do that? I have the short words there as to why, but why are we going to plot up drawdown versus log time? What information does that give us?
It gives us an idea when we reach steady state.
Okay. So if we're conducting a test and we're plotting this up during the test, when we start to see this approach a straight line, we say, okay, the duration of our test is such that we'll be able to use steady state analysis. So that's one reason why we would plot it up this way. Then the other way we can plot up the data is log of drawdown versus log of time. And the reason why we draw that up is that has the same shape as the well function, right? So if we look at the shape of our data, that will help us determine perhaps what kind of aquifer we have. And we saw this is in your notes, and we saw that for a confined aquifer, we get a very smooth curve that increases very rapidly initially, and then gradually at later times. But we don't have it flattening out, okay? And then we saw that if you have a leakage issue, you're going to see it flattening out. The drawdown will essentially stop increasing. So if you see this happening during the test, you either have leakage or you might have delayed yield, because we saw that delayed yield also has this kind of shape. So if you're looking at your aquifer and you see this flattening out, if you can, you should run the test longer, because you'd like to know whether it's going to come up again or it's going to continue to be flat. If it's a confined aquifer and it flattens out, chances are that it's a leakage issue, okay? What other things could cause a flattening out besides leakage? Anything else? Supposing we have a confined aquifer and we see it flattening out like that. We asked our Northwestern student. We pick on her today, so. You're welcome. No, do you have any idea?
No, I really don't.
Okay. Anybody have any idea? When it flattens out, it means the drawdown is not changing, right? So that means there's water coming in from somewhere. So where else could it come in except from leakage? Is there any other place it could come in?
A lake.
Okay, so we could have a recharge boundary. So if we saw this happening, it could also mean that we're getting water from some kind of recharge boundary. Everybody understand that? It means there's water coming in somewhere. Okay, so it helps then to plot up those two plots, one to give us an idea of when we've run the test long enough and the other to help us classify the formation. Now, we're plotting up the measurements as they're occurring, but it may be that we need to make so-called corrections to the drawdown. And in lab this week, you're going to talk briefly about corrections, but I want to explain what I mean by drawdown corrections. For instance, if it's an unconfined aquifer, we saw that we could do corrected drawdown, remember that? Where the drawdown, the corrected drawdown was equal to the drawdown minus, what is it, I'm going to screw this up now. Is it S squared over H what?
H naught?
How about that squared? No. Is it just A? Does anybody remember? I don't remember.
Maybe it's S squared. The units have to work out, right?
The units have to work out, so it should be S squared, right? Is it 2H?
I think it's 2H, yeah.
Anybody find it in their notes? Anyway, that's, you can see I don't memorize all the equations, all right? But we could correct, they call this correcting for dewatering, is what they call it. You would know the saturated thickness of the formation, so you could go ahead and make this correction. And then you could apply your method of analysis. So that's one correct type of correction. The other thing is, you might have an observation well during the test, which is out of the radius of influence of the well, so it's far away, and you could see a trend or a change in the water level over time. And this might be if you're conducting the pump test over a week's time period. It's unusual to happen over a short period of time unless you have a torrential rain or something. Okay, but what they call is a regional trend. And you can correct for the regional trend by subtracting it out from all your measurements. So you assume that the observation you make at some distance from the well is reflecting something else that's going on in the formation uniformly, and you apply a correction. So that's another type of correction. There are other types of corrections that relate to barometric pressure. If you have a storm passing by and you're making measurements in a confined aquifer, believe it or not, the barometric pressure can affect the water level measurements, okay? Because the height to which the water rises is in equilibrium with the pressure of the air. And if the pressure of the air changes substantially, it can influence the measurement in the well. And so there are ways to correct for barometric pressure changes. Another type of correction is for so-called partial penetration. If you have a well that's not fully screened, so here's your confined aquifer, and your well only penetrates the upper portion of the aquifer, and you're close enough in with your observation well, let's say, the Dupuy approximation, which says there's horizontal flow, doesn't necessarily apply anymore, right? And in fact, you'll see that there'll be some vertical gradient. And you can make a correction for that as well. And there are analytic solutions that help you decide what that correction is. But at any time, or for any of these corrections, what it means is adjusting the value that you observed to account for these effects. And you're going to get introduced to these in lab just briefly. But if you really are conducting a pump test and you need to look at these things, you want to get a manual, one of the two manuals that we talked about. And they provide guidance on these corrections. But the important thing is to know that you may need to correct your data. Okay? And you want to correct the data before you plot it up again. Okay. So everybody understand that concept? So we've got barometric pressure corrections, we've got regional flow corrections, we've got partial penetration corrections, we've got unconfined aquifer corrections. All right, once we make our corrections to the data, then we can analyze the data for real. And we would do that by plotting, again, on a long linear plot and using the large time data, using either Team or Jacob Cooper or both. And we've seen how we can do that. And all that is fitting a straight line, linear regression, very simple. And the alternative is to use all of the data and use a Tice type analysis. And we saw that the shape of the drawdown versus time curve looks the same as the shape of the well function versus 1 over U, right? It has the same shape. So that we can superpose the two on top of each other and just by reading off the coordinates estimate the transmissivity and the storage coefficient. So it's a graphical solution method that works because the shapes of these two are the same. And in lab this week, you're going to be working with software that does this for you. And I've deleted all the part of the assignment where you had to do it on your own. Okay, so you only have to use the software. But I do want you to understand the process, okay? Because you never know. Sometimes you might have to do it on your own, okay? But you'll only be using the software. Questions about those concepts? Everyone clear on that? Now, I've written a few anomalies that you might encounter if you're conducting a pump test. One is that you might see everything behaving very smoothly, and then all of a sudden, it starts to flatten out, let's say. This suggests that you have reached some sort of boundary, of a recharge boundary, that's supplying water. So this can happen. More often, I think you might encounter sort of a barrier boundary, or even a change in conductivity. So if you're observing the drawdown behavior, and then all of a sudden things seem to shift a little bit, it starts to increase more rapidly than you expect, or the rate of change decreases, that it might suggest that there's a boundary there that has to be accounted for. Okay. Now, how would you deal with that? Well, one way to deal with it is to use the earlier data, and when it's affected by the boundary, stop and the analysis. The other way is to try to use superposition in some way so that you can analyze the data, the full set of data. And again, all these pump test manuals have information on how to deal with boundaries, and it's beyond what we can do in this class. But they have specific instructions. If you encounter this kind of boundary or that kind of boundary, this is how you can go about analyzing the data. But I want you to be aware that it's an art rather than a science. Any two people given the same data will get a different result, almost guaranteed, even if you're using a computer program to analyze it. Okay. The other issue is anisotropy. The only way you can tell if you have anisotropy is to have wells in different directions, observation wells in different directions. And if you're setting up a pump test, you typically do that. You put observation wells at right angles to each other. So you could get some idea if the behavior was symmetric or not. If it's not symmetric, that suggests anisotropy or heterogeneity. Okay. Leakage we've already spoken about. And then, of course, if you see that classic S-type behavior, what you're seeing is delayed yield. And the other thing that we haven't talked about but is possible in the early time data, when you start pumping, if your well has a large enough diameter, the water is all coming from the well. It's not coming from the aquifer. So when the water comes from the well, what you're measuring is not the transmissivity of the formation. Okay? So usually you give more credence to the later time data. And if you have a large diameter well, there are even corrections for well storage. So you can calculate how the volume of the well will influence your drawdown, particularly if you're using drawdown right in the well. Okay, so there are corrections for that. Yes.
What is a large diameter well anyway?
A large diameter well would be on the order of 10, 12 inches, something like that, like a foot. Sometimes wells are large because of the need to get the pump down in there, and that affects things. It typically doesn't affect things at some observation point a fair distance away. But if you're using measurements within the well itself, it can confound your measurements because of the storage in the well. There's some rules of thumb about the size of the well that will affect that. It depends upon transmissivity, and it's a little formula you can use. Okay. Other questions? Yeah, John.
It's something related to this. On the one big pump test that I did, all the other engineers were really concerned about the amount of solids that would actually be pumped out of the aquifer. They were really clear that we had to check the suspended solids content in the water with time. They were concerned that we would actually be removing solids from that. And I don't know why. Is that a real concern, or were they just sort of barking up the wrong tree?
Well, why were they concerned about it? I'm not sure.
It was underneath a structure. I mean, the eventual structure would have been similar to our stadium and Ohio State Stadium. The Paul Brown Stadium is has a series of pumps around it just in case the Ohio River were to raise up so they could pump down the water table. And so they were concerned that if that happened, that they'd be pumping out so much they'd actually be removing enough soil, I guess.
Okay. I've never heard that before, but the types of applications that I've seen have been mostly aquifers with very little fines in them. So the only thing I've seen as concern with fines relates to clogging at the well screen. If you mobilize the fines, they can collect in the well screen and then cause clogging. And sometimes you have to start redeveloping the well again to avoid that. But I've never seen a concern that you're actually changing the properties of the formation, no.
Mm-hmm. Okay. These are some pretty big
wells.
Wells, yeah. Pumps. They're about a foot and a half in diameter.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know. I mean, I've never encountered an issue where a time where that would be an issue.
Well, a group of us thought that they were nuts.
Oh, well.
When we were the ignorant youth, they were just doing the stuff in the field, and they were the bright people.
Did they offer you an explanation? I mean, other than they didn't?
They were just concerned that they'd actually be removing a sizable fraction of material.
We often get mobilization of fines when we inject fluid that has different ionic strength from what's in the formation, okay?
Because
it flocculates the clays, okay? And so that's the example that I've seen. So in the lab, if you pack a column and then you flush it with a fluid that has a different ionic strength, you can get all the fines just flowing right out of the system, and then you've changed the character of the soil that you want to measure. So that's where I've seen it be an issue. But I've never seen it because of pumping fluid out, no. And that seems odd to me, but. Okay, so other questions? Okay, I want to go back to this example then just as a sort of a summary on how you might use these data. This is the aquifer that's in your notes for the unconfined example. And we talked about the fact that there was some coarse deposits down here and some finer sands up here. And we have a pumping well that's screened within the coarse zone, if I can find it again, right here. This is the well screen. And what we're doing is pumping there. But at first glance, it's not clear if this is a sort of a confined aquifer or an unconfined aquifer because of the stratigraphy. Have you guys found this? It's page 9.23. So it's not always clear if you're dealing with a confined aquifer or an unconfined aquifer in this case. I mean, obviously this is a permeable confining layer. So if it is confined or partially confined, it's probably leaky. So what happens is, what they're really trying to decide is whether to include those fine sands as part of the formation or treat them as a confining layer. So what do? Well, they put observation points up here above the fine sand, and they observe whether the head changes during the pumping. And the head did change substantially. Okay. Now you remember that when we talked about leaky confined aquifers, what we assumed was the head above the formation wasn't changing much because the confining layer was had quite a low permeability. So it would not be appropriate then, if you see the head changing quite a bit above the fine layer, it wouldn't be appropriate to treat this as a confined aquifer, as a leaky confined aquifer. So that's how they establish how to treat this. All right. Now the next step is they tabulated all their data, and they had observation points at a number of locations, but what's tabulated in here is the well that's 90 meters away from the pump well. And they have two piezometers at that point, and we're really going to focus on the deep one because that's the one that we're going to use for our pump test analysis. Okay. So the first step would be to plot these data, and if we're going to use the Tice method, we should correct them for dewatering. Okay? We should use correct to draw them. But what we're going to use instead is the Newman method. Now, the Newman method does not require that correction because the Newman method accounts for the vertical, remember? So we're not going to do any corrections on these data for dewatering. Instead, we're going to use them directly. And what I've done is to plot up the data. This is what you would actually do. If you would plot up the drawdown data on a log-log plot. This is not part of your course pack now. I've just plotted them up, okay? And I'm going to superpose them for you. So I've plotted the data up on a log-log plot here, and it's drawdown versus time. All right, that's the first step. And then what you do is you have a computer program that generates these type curves, or you generate them yourself. Probably you have a computer program that does. Okay, and you have have type curves of W versus 1 over U. Now the first thing we have to do is we have to select one of these type curves to match with our drawdown data. And this is an arc, as I said before. Which one fits? So this is on a different scale right now, but what I've done is I've selected a beta that I think fits. And if you go back and you were to do this, you might select a different beta. And who's right? There's no way to prove that I'm right. And there's no way to prove that you're right. But Newman has some equations for this thing, and you can plot up the equations and develop your own type curves. And his type curves basically have two forms. They're type A curves, and then they're type B curves. Okay, and they come together. They link together to form this S-shaped curve. All right. So what I've done here is plotted a type A curve that is for beta equals the 0.1. So that corresponds to this curve right here. Okay? So that's my judgment of how the best curve to fit to these data. But you can see they're very close to each other, and you'd be hard-pressed to select a unique one. Okay? So now I have my data plotted on the same scale as my type curve, and what I have to do is I have to superpose them. And this is, again, you can do this on the screen, you can do it on a piece of paper. You can have a code do a nonlinear least squares algorithm and get a perfect fit. But it's an art because you don't know which points you want to fit. Okay? They won't all fit equally well. So you can try to fit the early time ones or the late time ones. Now, which one should I be fitting to this curve? This is a type A curve. So which data should I give more emphasis to? Early time, right? That's what Sarah says. Everybody agree with that? Okay, so I'm going to, and this is where, now, it's hard to decide which is early, which is late, right? That's a judgment call. So if you're going to use a software that does a nonlinear least squares regression, you have to cut out some of the data. That's your judgment call. So no matter how you do this, whether it's totally automated, ultimately, it's still an R. You just have to remember that, and your answer will not be unique. Okay, so I had to select a curve, and now I have to select the data that I want to fit. And I don't know. You have to rotate. You can't rotate this thing like this, right? You can only move it horizontally and vertically. So the axes have to be parallel. And we have to try to fit it as best we can. And there's temptation to rotate it. So I don't know. Does that look good? Maybe not. Does that look better? Hard to say, right? So I don't have the answer preordained here. So we'll get a different answer depending upon how I fit this thing. What do you think? Does that look right? Does that look good?
Beta and then before.
What did you say?
Beta and then
before. Oh, earlier. Oh, dear. Humor. Attempts at humor, anyway. Okay, so I don't know. Let's see. That's one value here. 1 over u is equal to 1. And let's see. I'm not very good at reading it. Well, I can read it off after I'm going to look at the value. This is the value for w of u equals 1. And I'm going to see what the point is now on this one. I had to take it apart to read it. Okay? So 1 over u is equal to 1, and t is equal to what? I don't know. That looks like 2 minutes. And then that drawdown is equal to about 0.08 meters. Everybody see how I did that? So those are my match points. And now I need to do some calculations, and I actually brought my calculator today.
How did you determine those points?
Okay, what I did was, I probably can't reproduce it now, but I put the two curves on top of each other, okay? And I read off the coordinates on the bottom one first, okay? I read off the coordinates, and I read at one, I marked where that crossed this one, and at one on this axis, I marked where it crossed, okay? So I'm basically reading off two coordinates. And I just picked a whole number for this one and this one to make it easy.
Okay.
Everyone understand that? So that's my match point now. And now it's just plug and chuck. Now we just plug into the equations four, and if you want to look where they come in, we go back to this sheet where you calculate these two things, okay? So in order to do the calculation, we're going to need Q. We have the value for our well function. It was 1. We chose it to be 1. We have the value for drawdown. So then what we do is we say, okay, the K times the H0, that is going to be equal to Q over 4 pi S times W of U, okay? And this is equal to 1. This was equal to 0.08. And now I got to figure out what the pumping rate was for this test.
873
meters cubed per day. Thank you. Now this was in, there's no time, let's see. Okay, so that, plugging in those numbers, I should be able to get an estimate for transmissivity if I've done this properly. Okay, so 873 divided by pi, this is a new calculator, I don't know where pi is. Maybe somebody else should do the calculations. It might be faster. Should do that, 3.14. Okay. So we've got 873 divided by 3.14.
Wasn't that long enough?
I'm sorry, was the time long enough? No, they should have run it longer. But this is the only data you've got, so you've got to try to use it, okay? So I guess I would sort of match it like that, and I try to fit the data that didn't fit before to the earlier time plot. And I'd pull these data, this match point off the curve, and I do the same kind of calculation. And if I perform that same calculation now for these late time data, if I do it with a lot of skill, I get something close to what I got for the transmissivity estimate. Actually, I did this, and I came out with a transmissivity. It's not real close. I came out with a transmissivity of 695 meters squared per day, which isn't real close to the other number, is it? It's not real far, but it's not real close. So the question is, what's right, you know, which estimate? I would take the earlier estimate over this one, because the fit is really subject to a lot of uncertainty, okay? And then I also got a specific yield, and it came out with 0.07, okay? That's the Newman method, and that's also the same as a Tice method, really. It's the same kind of matching idea. Now, if you look at these numbers and you go back and you look at what I handed out for the solution that's presented in that manual, that pump test manual, they used a beta curve of 0.01 instead of the data. So they selected a different beta curve. They fit the data. You can say how well or how badly it fits. It looks like it fits about the same as the one we selected, okay? But they got a transmissivity of 1,400. And they got a specific yield value of 5 times 10 to the minus 3, which to me, as I said last time, seems a bit low and seems unrealistic. So if I had to make an argument for the calculations we just did, I would say they were better because we got a value that seems to make more sense. But I can't prove that my analysis is superior to the one that's presented in that book. And if we use their numbers, we can make a prediction that would give us the same data as if we use our numbers. So it's non-unique, basically. Does everyone understand this idea? Yeah. Beta is a measurement of the ratio of the vertical anisotropy, right? It's a measurement of the difference between the vertical conductivity and the horizontal conductivity, right?
So when you pick up a beta, you do guessing.
You're guessing a different value for the anisotropy, right? But there isn't an independent way of measuring that, unfortunately. Now, of course, if you have a bunch of different wells, you can try to use the same beta for all the wells and see if it works out. So that might help to give you confidence if all the data seem to fit the curve. And if some of the data don't, then it gives you less confidence in your estimate. Everyone get the idea here, though? I wanted to just give you a feel for this matching idea. Any questions? Yeah, John?
Yeah. How well does that equivalent, when you can calculate that an equivalent hydraulic conductivity, that you're kind of averaging over that area that of the radius of effectiveness of the well, so to say.
Right.
How well does that correlate with hydraulic conductivity measurements using different methods, such as soil type?
If you were to take the soil back into the lab and you were to measure in a permeameter, measure the conductivity, it tends not to correlate well at all. That's because that's a point measurement. And usually a larger measurement gives you a higher conductivity in general, I think, but I'm not certain about that. So I don't know about the trend. I guess it would depend upon the formation. But in general, people have found that if they want to look at water supply questions and they take cores back to the lab and they estimate hydraulic conductivity, those numbers won't be very useful. They'd be better off doing a pump test. Okay. However, if they're looking at contaminant transport, contaminants see very local variations in conductivity, and it turns out that it might be better to take a bunch of samples from the lab rather than to do a pump test. So it depends upon what you're trying to predict and how you're going to use the information. But no, they don't correlate particularly well. If you do a permeameter measurement in the lab and then you go back and you look at the Karman-Kozane equation, you can usually develop a pretty good correlation there. if you fudge it a little bit. So you can get a predictive correlation based on grain size and stuff like that. And those are empirical sorts of models. But if you want to apply it to the field scale and say, I'm going to predict drawdown based on this estimate, it generally doesn't work very well.
That's because you just probably don't have enough data.
There's two issues. One is you don't have enough sampling points, and what this is an integration.
Right.
And the other is the scale issue. When you take larger samples, you tend to get pathways that you wouldn't see in a small sample, you know?
If your sample
In fact, if you measure if you measure the conductivity in a lab and you have these big pieces of gravel in there, what do you do with them? You usually throw them out, right? But if you have in the field, it's seeing the whole sample. Okay? So that's the reason. It's not really mysterious, but it's hard to quantify. Other questions? Now, that sort of leads me into, I want to talk briefly about one type of slug test, because slug tests have become very popular in recent years because they seem to be more useful for estimates for contaminant transport. And they're easy to do. They don't require as much equipment. You don't have to pump any water from the well, so you don't need to dispose of contaminated water. You can do, one person can do a bunch of measurements in a day and get a lot of information. Okay? So they're actually very popular. And the way a slug test works is we change the water level in the well essentially instantaneously, and then we watch how it dissipates. And the way we usually change the water level is by putting in a slug. Okay, and that's why it's not a slug is not a little creature with a shell on its back. It's a slug is this solid aluminum sort of long tube, okay, that you can just drop into a well very quickly, and it displaces water, and you know its volume, so you know how much water you displace, okay, and then you can then watch as you have this initial value, you know, and then you can watch how it dissipates in the formation, how it moves out, okay, and so that's the way a slug test works. But when you make the measurements, all the measurements are in the well itself. So you don't need any other observation wells. You can do this in an observation well itself. You don't need a pump. So the well doesn't have to be very large in diameter. You can make these observations. But you're making the measurement in the well, so the information you're getting is very localized. So you're going to have essentially almost a point measurement of hydraulic conductivity. So the only way that's going to be useful for you is you have a bunch of point measurements. And we have some data from the Palgaman site for slug tests, and we also have some data for pump tests, and you're going to be able to analyze both of those in lab. Yay. Sarah's all excited. She can't wait. Okay. So the way the slug test works is the conceptual picture is, this is a confined aquifer, but there are analysis methods for unconfined, and I'm just going to go through the confined as an example. The idea is that you've got a well that's screened in the formation, and the water level is initially here. That's the piezometric surface. It's above the confining layer. And you have a well casing, and the well casing might be wider than the well screen, or it might be the same. So we've allowed it to be different here. Okay. And so what we're doing is we're going to raise the water level. Initially it's down here. We're going to suddenly raise the water level in the well, and we're going to watch how it dissipates. And all the same assumptions apply here. Confined, homogeneous, isotropic, infinite, you know, the usual stuff. But for this, most aquifers are infinite for this example because it's really localized. So you don't have to worry about barrier boundaries when you're looking at this. Okay? You want your well to be fully penetrating because you're still going to assume the Dupuy approximation is valid. And you're assuming that you change the head instantaneously. So it goes from here to here in essentially no time. You just drop this slug in and it comes up, okay? Everybody get that idea? And then you measure with a pressure transducer in the well, you measure the head as it changes over time. And that you can translate to a water level. So that's the way the test is conducted. You have a continuous readout of the change of head. And fortunately for us, Cooper Papadopoulos and somebody else, I forget, sorry, Radahop probably, developed a technique to analyze the data, and they have their own function. You know, I don't know what the name of it is. Instead of calling it a well function, they call it an F function. Okay, but it's tabulated, and you can get the numbers in tables like this. And beta here, remember U is 4t. What's it? I always forget. R squared s over 4tt, right? Well, you see this cropping up in the beta. This is a dimensionless number here. Okay. And then alpha relates to the ratio of the well casing to the well screen. Okay. Otherwise, it's just the storage coefficient. So it accounts for the extra volume that's stored up here, basically. And if they're the same, then it's just the storage coefficient. So what they've done is they've tabulated these for beta's values for different values of alpha. Okay. These are F values, different values of beta and alpha. Okay, so each column here represents an alpha. You should have something similar to this. I may not have given it to you, but you can get these tabulated and then you can plot them up. And so this plot is a plot of this F function. F function is on this axis, and beta is on this axis. And each of these curves represents a different alpha. Okay. Now, the way you calculate the initial head change is just by the volume of water that you're displacing and the radius of the well casing. Okay, so it's just a change in volume. Typically, you don't know what the S value is, so it's hard to figure out your alpha. So you can try to select an alpha that seems to fit your data, just like we did with the Newman method. Okay? And once you have a curve that you selected, then you use this matching approach the same way that we've seen, that we've done before. Well, we compute H0. H0 is the volume that related to the volume that we displaced, that is the initial change, and we calculate the normalized head. So we know what H is, and we divide it by H0, and we plot that versus log time. So this is kind of analogous to the drawdown versus log time. Okay. So what you do is you plot it on the same scale as your type curve. Notice this is a normal scale on this side and a log scale on this side, right? So this is a semi-log plot. So you plot that, and you superpose it with your data, and you read off your match points. And then you can compute your transmissivity. And your transmissivity is from your definition of beta. So if you find your match point at a given t and a given beta, you can calculate your transmissivity. That's all there is to it. So you can use this approach to get an estimate for transmissivity in the vicinity of the well. And then, if you want, you can use your alpha value also to estimate an x. Okay? But it turns out that the s values are not very reliable. And nobody trusts their S values that they get out of a slug test. And the reason is because the well and the packing around the well screen affects the storage coefficient that you get a great deal. Okay. So people use this to get transmissivity only. And sometimes they even assume an S. And based on the assumed S, they estimate an alpha, and then they use that alpha to fit their data, that curve. And there have been a lot of publications about the non-uniqueness of S with slug tests, and people have tried to develop very complicated slug test methods with perturbations and all kinds of interesting stuff to try to get at the storage coefficient. And so if you're interested, you can read up on that literature, but it's beyond kind of the scope of this course to cover that, okay? But there are more sophisticated methods. But most people currently use this sort of method to estimate the transmissivity. Very straightforward, very quick, One person can go out in the field with very limited equipment and make these measurements and get a lot of data on transmissivity this way. So it's very, very popular right now. And what you're estimating, the radius of influence, it's a little bit unclear. The well has some effect on your estimate because of the packing around the well. But presumably, if it's permeable enough, you are getting some estimate of the aquifer transmissivity also. And in their paper, Cooper et al. Argue that no matter which alpha you pick, the transmissivity value that you calculate is going to be only different by about 30% or so. So you can't go far up if you pick the wrong alpha. That's what they claim. So even if it's not unique, which curve you want to fit to this, they'll accept an estimate based on almost any of the curves. Okay? So that's a little bit about slug tests. And again, the same pump test manuals that describe the pumping tests also describe slug tests. And there's an even simpler method that's called the Bauer-Rice method for unconfined aquifers, which is like almost totally empirical, really. And there's some coefficients that you can use. And that's actually in the notes as well, but I'm just not going to go through that here. But I wanted to expose you to the concept of the slug test because that is important. And the data, as I said, are much more easily obtained. And so I think Dennis, correct me if I'm wrong, there's like 3 slug test data sets from Gelman, is that right, that we have? Or do we have more?
For each 11th EI.
11 what?
11, well, FW11. Ask the EI.
So that's all I'm going to cover on aquifer evaluation tests, but are there any questions? You can't learn all the details, but I think you should have a good enough appreciation now for where the equations come from and how we use them to estimate parameters. Because that's essentially what we do. And once we've estimated the parameters, we believe that we can make predictions with the estimated parameters. That's the reason for estimating them, right? We'd like to be able to make some predictions. Now, in your case, you're going to take that slug test data, and you're going to get some estimates, and you might be able to use those in your modflow model as a ballpark guess for the transmissivity. Now, but you're going to try to calibrate your real head data, right? That's your objective. So you have to have an initial guess for your transmissivity or conductivity. But once you put that initial guess and you don't get the right heads, then you've got to figure out, well, how certain am I in this estimate? How much variation do I think there could be? What other things could affect the heads? I mean, it's all going to be your judgment. But you can start out with these few observations of conductivity to give you a ballpark idea of what it could be at the site and how it might vary. But ultimately, you're not going to just take one number from that test and use it in your model, because chances are it's not going to give you a prediction that's consistent with observations. Everybody understand that? It's just going to be one other bit of information that you're going to have about the site. And the more information you have, the more constrained your model could be. So if you have some information about hydraulic conductivity, you certainly don't want to put a value in that's 3 orders of magnitude different. It would be hard to justify, right? But on the other hand, just because you have a single value doesn't mean that value is going to be spatially constant. Okay. Any questions? I keep asking that. John asked them. We missed you on the field trip. You would have asked lots of questions.
I know, and I love those things.
Okay, so thus ends the flow portion of the class. And we're going to move into transport now. So for the remainder of the lecture, what I want to do is just talk about transport mechanisms. No equations, or very little in the equation department. So now we've learned a lot about how groundwater flows in an aquifer. And what we'd like to do is try to understand how a contaminant that sits in the water is going to move. And for your project, as a first approximation, what are you going to assume?
Move the same as the water.
Right. Now, is that reasonable?
No.
Do you agree with him?
I think it's reasonable.
You think it's reasonable, Sarah? Okay.
Depends on the properties of the...
How about for dioxane, 1,2 dioxane? What do you think? Is it reasonable?
I think it should be.
Okay, why?
So that it makes our project easier.
Well, that's true. Okay. But that's, all right, I wanted a physical reason. I mean, Brendan had some idea.
As the guy said on Friday, it's a very miscible
It's
chemical.
Very miscible, you know, okay.
It travels very easily in the water.
Okay. So for us, but, you know, you're right, Sarah. There is a reason why we could use the water motion to describe it, okay? And it's because it is very miscible. And they believe that it doesn't absorb very strongly at all to the aquifer. We're going to talk about absorption. I don't know how many of you have had 460 are taking it now. Lisa shook her head. Are you learning about absorption in there?
Kind of.
Okay. Well, we'll talk a little bit about absorption, but we're not going to discuss it chemically too much in here. But basically, the organic portion of any aquifer material can sort of collect other organic contaminants, because the organic contaminants sometimes would prefer to be in the organic of the soil than it would be in the water, okay? But in the case of dioxane, it really is very happy to be in the water, so it doesn't absorb very much. So one might call it a conservative chemical, because it also appears not to degrade very much. And so the information is that it doesn't degrade much. I don't know how volatile it is. Does anybody remember? I forget.
I think it's very volatile.
But that would be another issue. Could it volatilize? Once it gets into the water, the air isn't exposed to it, right? So that it's not much chance for volatilization. But as it moves down into the formation, it could volatilize, and some of it could be lost. All right, so if it doesn't volatilize much, and it likes to be in the water, it doesn't absorb, it will move with the water. So we would call it a conservative tracer, and that is why we selected this contaminant at the site, okay, because we could treat it as a conservative tracer. Now, even a conservative tracer, though, will be subject to some other sorts of processes that will create a pathway that will be slightly different than the average water flow, and that's what I want to talk about first, okay? So as a first approximation, we can say it's going to move with the average water flow. But there are reasons why it may move a little bit differently, and that's what I want to talk about today, all right? So, imagine, I always use the cooking analogy, and I presume that's okay. You know, if you have salt and you put it in water in the kitchen and you don't stir it up, what happens? The salt, it always happens to me as the salt goes to the bottom, right? And it sits there, and then it dissolves away slowly, right? And as it dissolves away, what happens is it gets into the water, and the only way it can move is by diffusion. So if you don't stir it up, it's going to sit there, and it's going to dissolve slowly, it's only going to diffuse very gradually, so that you'd have to let it sit there a long time to get the salt to dissolve completely and have a uniform concentration in the pot, okay? And that process of diffusion is actually a very important one when we talk about contaminant transport. And presumably, diffusion is covered, what, in physics? Chemistry, where did they cover diffusion? Fixed law?
Mass transformation.
Where?
Mass transformation.
Yeah, well, what courses have you seen diffusion?
303.
303? Really?
And that we
numerical methods.
And
huh?
A big program.
Okay, a program on diffusion. Well, we're going to get that equation eventually. But the idea here is, like, if I release a contaminant or just a solute, we'll call it a conservative solute. So it doesn't absorb, it doesn't do anything. It's sitting here. And then I have a little barrier, and this is clean water out here. I remove my barrier, and I just watch how the molecules migrate into the clean water. That process is called diffusion. And the solute tends to move from high concentrations or high activities to lower activities. Okay. That's the process. And it is governed by a linear type of law. where the flux, and I've used a little J here, the flux of component I, it's a vector, it's got a direction, it's got a magnitude, it's proportional, okay, it's proportional to the gradient of the mass fraction in solution. That this omega thing is a mass fraction, so that's the mass of the contaminant over the mass of solution. So it, you can think of this kind of like a little Darcy's law in a way, where that we had flux is proportional to the gradient in the head, and now we have flux is proportional to the gradient in the mass fraction. It's a linear law in the same form. Notice the negative sign here, just like Darcy's law, right? So it's proportional to the negative gradient. Why is that? Preston, why is that? Looks spaced out.
Because it's going from high concentration to low.
Yeah, very good. You're not spaced out.
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so it's moving from high concentration to low, just like water moved from high head to low head. So that's why the minus sign is there, okay? And the proportionality coefficient is called mass diffusivity. It's the diffusion coefficient. Okay? And it has units of length squared per time. Does anybody know what the diffusivity of typical, like, salt would be in water? Anybody have an idea of the magnitude of that, since what kind of order it is? You can look it up in a handbook, a chemical handbook. But is this like a really big number in general? Does this thing, like if you watch this migrate because of diffusion, you have like a unit gradient in the concentration. Does this thing go millimeters in a second, or does it go meters in a second, or? I mean, what kind of?
Millimeters, maybe centimeters.
Yeah, okay, so even smaller than that, okay? Even smaller than that. It's on the order of 10 to the minus 5 centimeters squared per second, something on that order, okay? That's the kind of order that you're looking at mass diffusivity. And I should point out here that this is a mass flux, what we're talking about now. When we looked at Darcy's law, it was a volumetric flux, right? It was a volume per unit area per time, right? That was a Darcy flux. So this is now a mass per unit area per time. So the Darcy flux is a volumetric flux, and Fick's law gives us a mass flux. And this right here is just to convert mass fraction to concentration. So that's the mass density of the solution. That's the mass of the solution per volume. Okay, so that is Fick's law. And in general, this mass diffusivity is a function of temperature. As the temperature increases, the molecules move faster, and diffusion is more rapid. It's a function of composition. So depending upon the composition of the solution, a particular compound will diffuse more slowly or faster because it will interact with the other molecules in the solution. Okay? And it can also be a weak function of pressure. Now this is, if getting back to the idea of stuff moving with the water, this motion is independent. The water could be totally quiescent, right? It may not move at all. But we're going to have concentrations moving around. They're not concentrations, but molecules moving around, right? Now, where is this important? Well, it's important. Supposing I have a confined aquifer, and I have a clay layer up here, or maybe, and for some reason, there's contamination that has gotten into this formation. It's sitting here, okay? There may be no flow of water in the clay layer at all, okay? There may be no leakage in or out of the formation, but if this stuff is sitting there long enough, it's going to diffuse into this clay layer, okay? Now, that process is not fast. It's very slow, but you let this contaminant sit there for 30 years, and this stuff is going to have gotten into that clay layer. So now you come out, and you've got this super-duper pump-and-treat scheme, and you're going to flush all this stuff out of the confining layer. And then you go home and you say, I'm done. I've cleaned up the formation. And you come back out a little later, and lo and behold, you're measuring concentration in that formation again. Okay? How come? Well, what happens when you clean this stuff out? It'll diffuse back out. That's a slow process too. And you can flush it and the concentrations will go down again. And you stop and you shut the pumps off and you go home and you come out and measure it again and lo and behold, it's back again. Okay? So diffusion is an extremely important process in the environment. And it dissipates concentrations, but it moves them into layers that where they're less accessible. And this clay layer may have a high adsorptive capacity as well for this contaminant. So it may hold a lot. And then it may just bleed out very slowly. Okay, so diffusion is an extremely important process from that standpoint. And a lot of times people forget about diffusion when they do design and designs of remediation schemes. And so they're overly optimistic about how successful they're going to be. The good news is it diffuses out slowly. So we don't know if it's a health threat then, right? We keep flushing. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. Okay, that's diffusion. And there's another process now that tends to act on contaminants that is different than the average water motion. And the way I think about this is I imagine myself in a pour. And I'm in a pour, and do you guys remember what the profile of the velocity looks like in a pour? We talked about that. Remember Hagen-Poiseuille, or how do you pronounce that? What does it look like? Does anybody remember? Brendan says it was a parabola. Do you remember that? There was no slip at the boundary, right? It sort of looked like this. It was a parabolic profile, okay? Everybody remember that? And we averaged that, in fact, to get something that looked like Darcy's Law. Well, now I'm sitting in the pour, and I am subject to that flow field, and I'm a little molecule of solute. And I'm, at time zero, I'm released, and I'm one of these little molecules right here, all right? If I'm in the center of the pour, I'm going to just zoom out, right? Because my velocity, the velocity I'm going to see, I'm moving with the water, like Sarah said, okay? I'm moving with the water, I zoom out. The average velocity might be here, so I'm going to be moving faster than the average. Everybody see that? Now, if I'm at near the edges of the pour, I'm not going to move at all. I'm going to just be stagnant almost. Okay. So if then I take an average across the section at some time, I'm going to find that there's a stratification of concentration. It started out nice and uniform, right? But now if I look, there's going to be some concentration out here, but it's going to drop off. And it's not going to be perfectly sharp, you know? It's not going to just move. If this is the average velocity here, it's not just going to move with the average velocity. There's going to be some particles that get out ahead. Do you see that? If I take an average across the tube, I'm going to see a distribution of concentrations with space. And now what happens is, if I'm out here, okay, I have my friends around me, there's a few molecules around me now, okay, and what happens is, there's nothing out here, right, there's nothing out above me or below me, so I'm going to want to diffuse out and spread out, okay, so diffusion will create that natural spreading, and it'll cause then a zone where the concentration will decrease. Okay? And that's called something we call Taylor dispersion, because it was first modeled by Taylor in a capillary. Okay? But that process of spreading due to velocity stratification is called Taylor dispersion. Okay? So I'm moving with the velocity here. But the thing is, I'm not moving with the average velocity. Right? I could move a little faster or a little slower depending upon my position in the tube. So the net effect is to cause a spreading. Everybody see that? And that process of spreading due to velocity variations in general is called dispersion. And if you take, I'm not sure what course with Professor Catapodis, he and I always get into these semantic arguments. In surface water, he calls this thing turbulent diffusion. And I don't want to use the term diffusion unless I'm talking about Fickian diffusion, okay? So whenever we have a qualifying exam and he's on the examination committee, we get in this argument about what's dispersion and what's diffusion, okay? So in this class, when we look at mixing due to velocity variations, we're going to call it dispersion. And when we look at mixing due to to gradients in concentration, then we will call it diffusion, okay? So this is a dispersion phenomenon. And it happens in a little capillary. And so it could happen in a pore. But to tell you the truth, you know, I'm not really interested in measuring a concentration in a single pore, right? It'd be tough to measure it, and I'm never going to drink water from a single pore. I'm going to collect it from a lot of pores, right? So how relevant is this to groundwater contamination? Not terribly, all right? There's another process that's even more relevant, okay? Now imagine that I have managed to release some concentration in a pore, and I let it go. Is it going to stay in that single pore? No way, okay? It's going to move out of that pore because the flow field, you know, the flow field might separate out at the local scale. What's going to happen is I'm going to see molecules going in all different directions because the grains are sitting there and they're in the way, okay? So the average flow might be in this direction. But if I was to actually look at the flow path of all the molecules, they would all be different. Do you see that? And that process also spreads out contamination. Okay? And that we have a name for. It's called mechanical dispersion. And this process turns out to be terribly significant for groundwater contamination. And this is the dominant process in contaminant transport. So we start out with a small release of the contaminant, and as it moves out, it spreads because the flow paths are not really straight. The flow paths are tortuous. And once it moves, it can never come back again because of diffusion. The spreading just keeps increasing. It never goes negative. If it does, something really weird's going on. Actually, I think you could observe some weird anomalies like that in the field if you suddenly had channeling or something. I suppose you could get the concentrations moving back into a layer or something, but it's very rare that you see that, okay? Generally speaking, things spread and they spread and they spread more, okay? Now, so this is called mechanical dispersion, and it's basically it's due to variations in the velocity, magnitude, and direction, okay? Any questions about that process? Yes, John? You have a question?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, I have my list that you gave me at the beginning of class. I'm not done with it.
Oh, okay.
There was a model that I always picture where it's like random walk or like the Brownian movement where they just sort of, they're not based under any gradient or anything, but they're just going to kind of randomly move around. Which one does that fit into?
Well, actually, it's...
That are not grammar right.
It fits in with this idea, actually. And you're leading me into the next subject. The question is now, this is sort of at the pore scale, right? This is what happens in a capillary, in a single pore, in a few pores. What happens if we step up a scale? How do people look at that? All right. The way people look at it one way is called the random walk model or the drunken sailor model.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey. Instead of a drunken sailor model. So the idea is I'll move with an average velocity, but then there'll be some deviation from my path. It's random. It's based on the unknowability of the pore structure. And so people assume that it's totally random, and they come up with a model of dispersion based on that. And in fact, there's an Illinois Water Survey model, which is called the random walk model, which is used for it's used for groundwater contamination predictions. So the way this model works is you take a particle, you release it, it moves with an average velocity, the average flow, but then we can't know the precise flow field, so then it can move off of that path in some arbitrary random direction, not arbitrary, but random direction, okay? And then from that point, it moves again with the average flow and moves again in a random way, and so you get a certain kind of behavior. And in fact, guess what that behavior, how that behavior can be described? It can be described with a Fickian model, believe it or not. It can be described as though it follows a fixed law type of analysis, even though it's based on some entirely different mechanism, even though it's based on velocity variations. You can still describe it with a fixed law model, believe it or not. So that's what I would call the statistical model here. The random walk is one of the statistical models that you can use to describe dispersion. Other people have been more mechanistic in terms of structure, and they've looked at capillary tube models. And they've looked at, if you have a bunch of pores together, how will they behave versus, you know, a single pore. And in my 528 class, we spent a lot of time talking about these. So people have tried to develop conceptual models of how contaminants behave based on these processes we talked about. And they want to get an equation that describes this process at a higher scale. And guess what they come up with? Fick's law all over again. Okay? Now, this is not really Fick's law, but it's a way to express dispersive flux as a function of the gradient and concentration. Okay?
Do you add that to the flux due to Fick?
That's right. So the two are additives. You get movement due to diffusion, and you get movement due to dispersion. Okay. And the coefficient now is not the mass diffusivity anymore. It's the hydrodynamic dispersion. Okay. So if you were to run an experiment, let's skip a page or two. There's a little figure I want to talk about. Here's a column experiment. Now I'm going to scale up a little bit. Packed my column with sand. It's just like where you measure your hydraulic conductivity. A column, let's say, that size. In fact, you're going to do a lab, is it 2 weeks from now? 3 weeks?
Totally.
2 weeks. You're going to do a lab experiment with a tracer. And you're going to do this experiment. Well, what I'm going to do now, let's supposing I pump water through the system, and at time T0, the water I pump in has a certain concentration, C0. And initially there is nothing, no tracer in the column. At time zero, suddenly I'm inputting a concentrated solution. All right? If there was no dispersion and no diffusion in the world, this thing would move down with the average velocity, right? It would just move like a plug flow. And if you've taken 460 or 360, I don't know what the numbers are anymore, you'd get plug flow reactors. Does that ring a bell? Okay. You would expect sort of plug flow if you did not have any dispersion. But we have dispersion. We have dispersion because of this tortuous path the solute has to take. It can't go straight through a particle. It has to go around the particle. So what actually happens is it starts out kind of flat, and as it moves down, it continues to spread. And the more it moves, the more it spreads. Okay? And we aren't able to measure along the column what the concentration really looks like, because you have to put ports in the column with little probes, and it causes leaks, and it's a real pain. Okay, so instead, what we do is we measure what comes out the end of the column, and that's what you'll do. So if you watch what comes out the end, nothing comes out the end at first, right? And then after a little while, you start to see something come out, but it's not as concentrated as what you put in, so it's dispersed. And this is what it looks like when it comes out. So it starts out low, and it increases finally to the value that you injected. And then it'll stay there. Okay? But there'll be a transition over which it will not be at the high concentration. This transition is caused by dispersion. If there were no dispersion in the world, it would come out right here. And it would go from zero to the concentration that we input immediately. Okay? But dispersion spreads it out. And it turns out that this amount of spread here can be related to that dispersion coefficient. So you can estimate a dispersion coefficient in the lab from the spread that you observe. Yeah, John?
How do you know that you're calculating the dispersion versus the diffusion?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, since they're both exactly the same form, don't they just get...
How would you determine? You ask the question, can you answer it? What do you think? No, seriously, I'm not... What do you think? How could you distinguish between the effects?
I can't figure it out.
Okay.
I would... if I were measuring this, it would seem to me that you're measuring Fick's law of diffusion, that there's no way of breaking out that component where the particles are just randomly going around. Although,
anyone have an idea how we might distinguish?
Is it that you have a set concentration in the liquid going through at first, so it's not actually dispersing?
It's not actually dispersing. Well, it is dispersing as it moves through. So I do agree with John. I do agree with John that both effects are occurring. Okay. So now I've got this data that I have, and I want to try to separate the effects. So I believe we can probably make a stab at it. But how might we do that?
Wouldn't you have a higher concentration at the center of your column due to diffusion?
Higher concentration. What do you call
your velocity profile? I guess is going to be slower on the sides and then the center of the column. So your initial readings could be diffusion, and then once it equals out.
You mean, are you picturing the velocity profile like that?
Yeah.
But you know, it's not like that in a soil column. It's like that in a pore. But if you were actually to try to measure the velocity profile in a soil column, it wouldn't look parabolic. And in fact, a lot of times people think it looks fairly flat, you know? So unless you really go close to the wall, the velocity is fairly uniform, if you've packed it well. So there isn't a lot of velocity stratification. But, well, I was thinking that we know what the magnitude of diffusion is, right? We can measure that in a different experiment, can't we? We could look it up in a handbook at a given temperature, right? There are correlations that help us estimate diffusion. So I guess my argument would be that we can separate effects out because we can estimate how much diffusion would be responsible for the spreading, okay? And then now, the only thing we don't account for when we do that is we're imagining it's diffusing in clean water, you know? We have these soil particles in the way, right? So how will they affect diffusion? You got the soil particles in there. Would they increase it or decrease it? What do you think?
Decrease
it, right? I mean, if I'm a molecule and I got to diffuse, but I bump my head on the soil particle, I got to move around it, it's going to slow me down, right? So diffusion tends to be hindered a little bit in soil. And so I would argue, John, that if I measure a large spreading, and I look at the order of magnitude of diffusion and how much that could contribute to it, it's usually negligible. So even though it's happening, it may be negligible in comparison to the dispersion effect. And I can estimate the order of magnitude by knowing the order of magnitude of the diffusion coefficient. So indeed, I can separate them. And we'll talk more about that next time, because as usual, we're kind of jumping ahead. So my understanding is Wednesday, was it 5? There's going to be a review of the exam, and it will be in this room?
I'll send out an email.
Okay.
If I pick one up, it'll be already.
Okay. And Dennis has homework to return to people. Okay.
Number 7, right here.
Thank you.
taking 450?
Yes.
Okay. How many extensions are you taking?
But yeah, it's sort of the.
I'd like to get a little bit idea how that's going. People are willing to talk to you about it. So I can hear some stuff. Yeah, I mean, it would be confidential, believe me. I'm just curious about it. The first time it's been taught, and it's been good that it's been working. She's concerned, and I want to try to get it out. We might have to change the course around. I want to know where it is now.
Okay.
Because I've been hearing things, and this is like